All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuckadelics, what the fucking ears, what the fuckaholics? What's happening? This is Mark Maron. This is WTF the podcast. Yes, Keith Richards is on the show. He's got a new album out, Cross-Eyed Heart, which is out now. It's a sweet record. It's closer to Talk Is Cheap, which was a great solo record. There's a documentary, Keith Richards, Under the Influence. It's now on Netflix that everyone's loving. I got to watch it. But I talked to him. I talked to Keith Richards. Okay, am I going to keep it together just even to do this intro? Oh, my God. This is a pretty big day. Might be the biggest day ever. I don't know. It was a pretty insane day for me when this episode was recorded. I can tell you that. Okay? I mean, I know some of you know that Keith Richards looms large in my psyche and in my heart, people. And I don't think I'm alone in that. Yeah, I know that there's people in my generation, maybe the generation before me and the one before that and the one after me, that Keith is just the guy, all right? He was just the guy. I mean, there are those of us who idolized and still do just that outlaw rock and roll image that he created and remains. I mean, I don't even know if I can explain it, but there was just something about Keith. And those who get it, get it. I mean, Keith was just like the personification of fuck you. And there was something about that with a guitar. He was just a big fuck you with a guitar. And I was compelled, man. I don't even know when it first happened to me. I mean, I knew the Stones, but there's an issue of Guitar Player magazine with him. It's not even a particular good picture with his eyes half closed with that fucking Telecaster, that TV yellow Telecaster, just leaning into it. And I was like, God damn it. That's it. That's all of it. That's all you need is whatever's going on right there. That's all you need. And it wasn't even about being in a band or anything. It was just something about Keith and about drugs and about fuck you and about style and about all of that. I mean, I'm fortunate that I didn't pursue the exact life he represented. You know what I mean? I mean, not so deeply that I died for it or got strung out. I'm also fortunate that I didn't pursue a life in music. I only say that because I just wasn't cut out for it. I was not that good a player. Wasn't that confident necessarily, which I learned now is really all you need. I mean, but, you know, being in a rock band was just not the direction that my ego was dragging me at that time. And also, I think it would have diminished it. My love and worship for fucking Keith Richards. The coolest guy in the fucking world. And I know that may sound hacky to some of you kids as I condescend to you. I know even using the term rock and roll may sound dated and weird, but Keith Richards was the original thing. Mark Lehner, the writer once, I think he was in an article for Spin. I couldn't find it because I was looking for it, said that Keith Richards moving across the stage was like the EKG of rock and roll. And I thought that was just fucking beautiful. I actually wrote to him to find out exactly what he said, but he had no recollection of it. But it's a weird thing with Keith because my relationship with him is ongoing. Because my love of a particular type of rock and roll came directly from Chuck Berry somehow, through my father and through listening to the American Graffiti soundtrack and my father's love of oldies. I was just captivated by Chuck Berry and by that original riff. You know, the riff. And then like years go by where I'm loving Keith. I love the Midnight Rambler song more than anything in the world. And I don't even understand, you know, what makes Keith the amazing guitar player that he is. And over the years, you know, to understand Keith's rhythm and to understand, you know, why he's amazing, you know, because he's not like other guitar players. He's fucking Keith Richards. But the way he lays back and the way he nails a chord and the way that he decides what the rhythm is for a song and where it's at. I mean, it's fucking, you know, he's fucking Keith, man. And I know some of you heard, like, I could barely keep my shit together when I did that 10-minute interview with him. And some of you know that I read his book like it was a Bible that I could believe in. And I was blown away by his book because for years, you know, you just sort of keep Keith tucked away in your mind as this amazing, you know, dope fiend survivor. You know, this icon that represents the sort of like dark heart of rock music in some way. And then you read that book and you're like, holy shit, he's one of the great, you know, intelligent bullshit spinners of our time. There's a lot of hard truth, a lot of fact, a lot of history, but the dude can tell a story. And it, to me, that was just like, this only makes it better. This only makes Keith bigger, looming larger in my mind in different ways. And I guess it's just a big fucking, you know, love note to Keith Richards. But I was offered the opportunity to interview him. Now, you know, the Obama interview was intense and huge and an amazing event and an amazing interview. But I thought that, you know, I got my shit together. I knew what I was going to talk to the president about. You know, I prepared. I stayed focused. I think you could, you know, hear my nervousness was tangible in the first 5 or 6 minutes, but I think I eased into it. And, you know, within a very short time, I was calling him man and finishing his sentences for him. That's the leader of the free world. Could I keep my shit together with Keith Richards? Did I prepare? So my interview with Keith was to take place in New York City. It was to take place at the NPR building in an NPR studio because Keith was coming down from Connecticut to record Morning Edition. So we got to, the publicist, Fran, who was amazing, set us up to use the NPR studio after he did Morning Edition for an hour. And, you know, Brendan McDonald, my producer, business partner, who you met on the episode after Obama, you've met him before if you've been around a long time with the show. You know, we go down there to NPR and we get there on time and we're informed. We sit down in a conference room with Fran and another person from her organization, the Publicity House. And we're told that Keith is stuck in traffic coming down. He's running a bit late, probably an hour late. He got stuck behind a funeral procession. I'm not even fucking kidding. So we talked to Fran for a little while, and this we were in a conference room where they were going to, you know, meet Keith, and then he's going to do Morning Edition, and then he was going to regroup in there. And I noticed, you know, on the counter, there was a small case of vodka miniatures and a 2 6-packs of, I believe it was Sun-Kissed Orange Soda. So I'm like, that's the new fuel. Hey, I'm putting shit together. And so Brendan and I go, and we go to Bryant Park, and, you know, we have something to eat, and then we come back. And we're waiting. And Keith's about to show up, we were told, and I don't even want to see him. I don't want to see him. I don't want to have eye contact with him. I don't want to, I can't handle it, man. I can't handle it. So Keith shows up. I hide in an office. He goes into the studio to do Morning Edition. And at some point I'm talking to Brendan. I'm like, this is fucking crazy, dude. We're at NPR, you know, we're, what, it doesn't matter. I'm going to interview Keith Richards for, it's just crazy, man. And I was trying to keep it together, but this was sort of a big deal when somebody is your childhood hero. It's like, you know, some of you got all excited when so-and-so signed your baseball. Yeah, I mean, come on. Waiting to meet Keith Richards, the guy that I think defined a lot of my personality for a lot of years. Like I said, I'm lucky I lived, and I'm lucky that there was some part of me that didn't let me drift into complete pseudo-Keith Richardness. There was always some part of me, some part of my mind or my heart that would throw me a line when I got too far out to drift and saved me from sort of living on the dark side. But there we were, me and Brendan, waiting to talk to Keith Richards. He's in the studio at NPR, National Public Radio in New York City. And at some point, a woman comes up a bit. She comes out of a hallway a bit frantic saying, he's smoking in there. He's smoking a cigarette in there. And I was like, oh, that's so fucking beautiful. Keith Richards is smoking in an NPR studio of all places. Oh, fucking the human fuck you lives on. And the beautiful thing was, is no one was going to fucking stop Keith Richards from smoking a cigarette. No fucking way. So I'm waiting. And we're just waiting. And then I hear that he's finishing up. And then I go hide in this office because I do not want to see him. I do not want to meet him. I don't want to do anything. So then we're told that he's going to regroup. He's going to go into the conference room and reload, whatever. So I go into the studio and it smells like cigarettes. There's an ashtray there. There's a pitcher of water. I've got my little tube of nicotine lozenges, and I'm sitting in there, and I got my little scribble sheet, and I'm waiting for Keith. And I'm just sitting there, and then there's commotion, and I see outside the booth in the glass, Keith Richards walking in with a Captain America T-shirt on. And, man, I don't know, dude. Like, I stood up, and I'm like, Keith, you know, and, oh, boy. So I guess, like, so we sat down, and I'd like to say that you know, I kept it together. I'd like to say that the nervousness, the fanboy excitement receded, or I got it together after a few minutes, like I did with the president, but I don't think I did. I was very excited and beside myself. And, you know, we talked a lot about music. You know, I've loved the Stones a long time, and, you know, I'm sort of hung up. You know, like, we talk about Bill Wyman, the original bassist. We talk about, you know, the whole arc of the career. You know, the history of the Stones is the history of modern rock and roll in a lot of ways. And I sat there with Keith. He came in. He walked in the studio trying to fucking recapture it in my head. It was amazing. He had a big one of those sort of like keg party cups, like the red plastic cup filled to the brim with something iced and orange. And he was chipper and present and a little loopy. But it was I would have taken Keith any way it happened. But he was fun. We had a good time. And there's something that happened after we hung out. It was because we were doing pictures. And he put his arm around me and he gave me a hug. And he said, "You're a fun one." I don't want what, but you're a fun one. So I don't know if you knew that, folks. But after this interview, whatever happened, Keith Richards declared me a fun one. So Rolling Stones fans, lapsed Rolling Stones fans, or people who are too young to appreciate the fans, this is a historical document of a fucking lifetime fan meeting his fucking hero. So so enjoy this, all right? I did. Me and Keith Richards.
Hey, man. Nice to meet you.
Pleasure, man.
Wow. Let's do it.
Okay.
We're on. I got my nicotine candies. You got yours?
Oh, baby, yeah. Right
here. You got the real ones. Oh, I miss the Marlboro Reds.
Yeah, man.
I actually thought about smoking. I thought if there was a time to start again, it would be with you.
Yeah. My gosh.
Let me just hold one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You can just look at it if you like.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, man.
What are we drinking this afternoon?
Nuclear waste.
Oh, perfect. That's good.
Yeah.
You've adapted to it. No problem.
I'm ahead of the game.
I figured you'd drink nuclear waste. You have to, right? Just to keep going?
No, just to talk to you.
I'm dying to figure out what I'm going to light this fucking cigarette. You know what's interesting? Let's see
if you can hold out.
Okay, I'll try. It's been about a decade, but I think I talked to you briefly on the phone. I don't know if you remember. I'd like to think you would remember. We talked. I told you that I started smoking because of you. I started drinking because
of you. Oh, you're the one.
I'm the one. Good one. That's good. But it was funny because I remember reading an interview with you, and they asked you what kind of cigarettes you smoke, and you said, well, Newport, sometimes Marlboro Reds. So I was about 14, and I went out and got a pack of both and just, you know, played it out, see what stuck.
Yeah, I don't know where they got the Newports from.
You never said it. Never tried it.
Marlboro Reds, yeah.
Yeah, right? Well, whatever. I was walking around with both in high school trying to figure out how to be Keith Richards.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was a rough few years.
I was in school trying to figure out how to be Keith Richards. too. Strange, isn't it?
You figured it out. Well, you're like, I interviewed the president a few weeks ago, and I'm actually a little more frazzled about this because, you know, presidents come and go, but, you know, you're Keith Richards, you remain forever.
That's sort of one of the blessings.
You're like royalty, man.
Oh, I don't know about that. I've no crown.
Yeah? Are you sure? I think you do. I think you do. Well, this is like I'll get through the nerves in a minute, but it's a big deal to meet you because you're a big idol of mine. Now, when you started playing and you guys started to, you know, sort of come into your own, do you remember the first idol of yours that you met?
Oh, Little Richard.
Really?
Yeah. And Bo Diddley.
Really?
Because we were thrown onto this tour. I mean, before that, we'd been working clubs, you know. I mean, suddenly we had a record. And we were thrown on this tour with Little Richard, Bo Diddley, and the Everly Brothers. Uh-huh. And so I suddenly met, you know, half of my...
childhood.
Mentors. And, all in one, and I'm working with them too, you know, which was an amazing education. I mean, that's a university for me.
Uh-huh. Did you talk to Bo? Did you ask him questions?
Yeah, we were on the road for like 3 or 4 weeks.
Really?
You know? Yeah. I used to take care of Jerome Green, was his maracas player.
Uh-huh.
And Jerome was a great lush.
Yeah.
And it was my job to get him out of the pub, to get him on stage.
It's funny, I think those roles changed later in life.
I was willingly happy to do it, you know. I mean, Jerome was a loose cannon, and, you know, somebody had to do it.
Right.
So we ended up becoming great buddies, and Bo. Little Richard was amazing to watch.
Yeah.
His stagecraft, let alone his music. I mean, he had an English band with him, which they weren't bad.
A pickup band?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. But they were pretty good. But I mean, I'd have wished he had his own band with him. But at the same time, man, the way he would, you never knew where he was going to appear from.
Right.
I mean, he'd let that band play Lucille, let the riff.
Right.
For like 5 minutes, you know, nonstop.
Right.
In total darkness, you know. Dun, 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 dun. And then he'd turn up in the back of the auditorium, you know, with the spotlight on him. And
walk through the crowd?
Yeah, and then walk through. And I went, wow, the way you can work a room, man, I'm learning things.
Right. You almost been learning things.
And the Everly Brothers, I mean, so meticulously beautiful.
Those harmonies, right? Wow.
Yeah.
And you were with him for like 3 weeks you did that tour?
Yeah, 63.
So that was before England's Newest Hitmakers or around the same time?
It had just come out about the same time. Yeah.
When was the last time you listened to that record?
The odd track, round again. Yeah.
It's a weird thing because, like, I listened to that record a lot, you know, and I came to the Stones like much later because, I mean, I'm 51,
yeah,
so I was picking
youngster.
It up, right? But that record, I played the shit out of that record. To me, that was, you know, the pure intention, the birth of it all.
Yeah, in a way, I guess it was for us anyway, and it was recorded in this little room that professed to call itself a studio.
Yeah.
The whole walls were covered in egg boxes. That was called soundproofing.
Right, first class, yeah, top notch.
And it was a Grundig two-track, but it was hung on the wall.
Yeah.
Instead of, if it was on the table, it would have looked like, you know, unpro. But it's hung on the wall.
Give it a professional feel.
Yeah, man, yeah, but we cut the whole damn thing on that, you know. And it was, so I started on two-track, really.
Right.
Basic.
Yeah. Did you do Honest I Do?
Yeah.
Is that on that one?
Yeah.
Can I Get a Witness?
Can I Get a Witness? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me.
Yeah, yeah. And like that, you set out to be a blues band.
Yeah.
Right?
That was the intention.
Pure.
Yeah.
Straight up.
Yeah.
And at that time, you know who I talked to? I don't know if you guys are friends or not. A couple of weeks ago, I talked to Richard Thompson. And
we're not friends because I hardly ever see him. I know the man.
Like, because I think he was a little younger, but he was talking about the scene in London at that time. There were so many bands, and you guys would all see each other late at night, like at restaurants, and see each other play all the time. And what was the scene you were involved in? It was all blues, right?
Yeah, I mean, we were strictly, at that time, at the beginning of the Stones, strictly blues. We were almost Jesuits. Well, let's say missionary.
Uh-huh.
But no, our whole aim was to turn London on to, like, you know, rhythm and blues on the blues. And
right.
That was like the scope for the whole universe would be.
Right.
That. You know, and so I have 3 or 4 or 5 gigs a week, and that would be, you know, that's it. You know,
who were your guys early on? Who were the dudes that you were the most trying to emulate on the guitar? Like before Chuck, the straight up blues dudes.
T-Bone Walker.
Oh yeah.
And Muddy Waters, very simply buddy guy.
Yeah. Slim Harpo, later?
Slim Harpo, man.
Jimmy Reed.
Jimmy Reed was hard on Jimmy Reed.
Yeah.
Because we were not so much interested in being virtuosos. I mean, it was how those guys got that sound.
Right.
And to us, it was the thing of trying to get close to making that kind of sound.
Yeah.
And we studied, man.
What, you and Brian?
We studied and starved.
Yeah.
You know?
What was Brian's thing? What was he into most? Were you both
Brian,
in the same thing?
Brian, very big into Jimmy Reed.
Okay, yeah, so that's where that came from. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, so Mick and I were also into him, but Brian had the records.
Right.
We didn't, Mick had the Muddy Waters, and I had the Chuck Berry. Brian had the Jimmy Reed.
Okay, all right.
So, I mean, there was an obvious collection, and a connection. But Jimmy Reed stuff, I still think, is some of the most beautifully recorded stuff, and it's so simple.
Yeah, he plays he does a weird thing right on the five. He leaves that open.
Because if you're playing an E, when he's playing the five chord, he lets the three chord, the seventh note, still hang.
Right, he leaves the A open, right?
Leaves it open. I learned that from Bobby Goldsboro.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean,
he hipped you to that bus.
He hit me to that because he'd been on the road with Jimmy Reed. So he hipped me to, the weird thing that makes that sound is like he does this. He leaves the open A string going, man, I've been trying to get that for years. I would never have figured it,
It's funny how those moments happen. I imagine there must have been a few of those moments, like when you were putting together your chops, where you're like, oh, fuck, that's how that goes.
Yeah. Are you kidding me? I mean, you keep looking, how did he pull that lick off?
Right.
I mean,
even with Chuck, when you did that fucking movie with him?
Yeah, man. Bless his heart.
We had the argument about the beginning of O'Carroll.
Yeah.
That was touch and go, man.
Well, that was him testing me out, and pushing. Chuck always has to be numero uno.
Right.
After all, the movie's about Chuck. To me, I'm living my childhood dream of being a second guitar behind Chuck Berry,
You never knew what a pain in the ass that would be, I guess.
I tell you what, at the same time, he's a funny guy. I mean, mercurial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
1 minute, grouch, and then he'd piss off for half an hour.
Yeah.
And he'd come back and he'd be
back on top.
Did he take a hit or something? he was a great mood changer, but incredible to work with. And I think my best feat out of that was when I said to Chuck Berry that Johnny Johnson's still around, because Ian Stewart, who had just died that year, who was the Stones piano player.
From the beginning.
I mean, actually, I consider the Stones to be Ian's band.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. He put it together.
Really?
He poured us together. Without him, we wouldn't have coagulated.
And he only got pushed. He stopped being in the main lineup because what happened?
Oh well, he wasn't good looking enough, and it was like they thought six was too many.
Okay.
Stu, having the largest heart in the world, said, "Yeah, I understand that. That's cool." But we recorded. It was still his band.
He
became our roadie, our manager, road manager, and everything, take care of everything. So I think that Ian Stewart considered us his baby, and I consider him my dad.
Oh, that's sweet. But so your relationship with Ian sort of made you reach out and find Johnny.
Yeah, because the last thing that Ian Stewart ever told me is, and this was just before he died, he said, "Don't forget, Keith, that Johnny Johnson is alive and playing in St. Louis."
Right? Ian said that to you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And within a year, I'm working with Chuck Berry. Yeah. And I was saying, you know, in my mind, I'm saying to myself, well, without Johnny Johnson, it's never going to be the same. So I say to Chuck, "Hey, Chuck, Johnny around?"
Yeah.
And Chuck comes with a very deadpan. He's in town. Any chance of getting him together on this thing? I'll give him a call.
Yeah.
And the next day there was Johnny, and then I realized I had
the band,
the stuff.
Yeah.
And I realized that I had the stuff that had actually made Chuck's records and
sound so good.
Yeah.
And that he literally learned how to play those licks from Johnny's piano playing.
Yeah.
That Johnny was first.
Yeah, actually, yeah.
And that it's weird when I watch that movie, because I've been a fan of yours my whole life, but I'm not sure I necessarily understood, you know, how complicated the rhythm of Chuck Berry is and how you deconstructed that to get your shit.
Yeah, it's a variation on the theme, but Chuck and I basically play the same. It's basically the role.
Right.
You know, it's syncopation.
Right.
And for that, you need a drummer that you can totally rely on, you know.
Yeah.
And which is, unfortunately for Chuck, once he'd used pickup bands for a
long time. Went away.
Yeah, because he couldn't rely on the drummer,
right.
And they were just bands he'd never met, you know.
Right.
Which was unfortunate in that respect. But
because there's a bounce to it.
But I've no doubt Chuck walked out with the money.
In a briefcase.
Yeah.
In a Cadillac.
Oh, I know that briefcase.
But that's it. That's a bounce. It's a bounce, right?
It's a cut against the beat, you know.
Right.
But the drummer has to be right on
for
you to be able to, like, chop the beat around and move it and,
right.
And make it roll.
Yeah.
That's the roll in the rock, you know.
And that, right. And that's Charlie.
Yeah.
Solid.
Can I count on that man or what?
You know, yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. You know, I imagine you know, but yeah, I think, what was it, Abco reissued a few of the old ones.
Yeah.
They reissued Get Your Yayas Out, right? So yeah. I used to listen to that shit in high school, right? And I put on the reissue. And I had this moment in my living room where I'm like, holy fuck! Bill and Charlie are holding this whole thing together right now.
Yeah.
Did you
hey, nothing like a good rhythm section.
Like, until I heard that remaster and the way you guys were all fitting together, I was like, Jesus, man, that's so solid. But I don't know why. I think in the live situation, I think Mick even said something about it, that they were nailing it that night. Do you have memories of those nights in particular that you recorded?
Man, you know, when you're on stage, no, quite honestly, no, because I'm not thinking about we're being recorded or filmed, which is even worse, because people get aware of the cameras and they start to tighten up.
You know, no tightening up.
I try and forget all about what's going on around me.
Yeah.
Just do the gig.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw you in San Diego, I went. Just now, the first night of the tour.
Yeah. It got better and better, too. And that was a good show.
It was a good show. It was a great show. I was nervous. I was nervous for you. I don't know what the hell's
wrong. I love you.
I hadn't been to see you in a long time. I saw you guys in 81 at Madison Square Garden when I guess it was probably the Tattoo U tour, and Screaming Jay Hawkins opened for some reason.
Oh, yeah.
I think James Brown was supposed to, and then something happened. I don't know what happened. But
probably didn't like Screaming Jay.
Yeah, I don't know, but it was just weird. Screaming Jay comes out with the voodoo stick. Yeah. I don't even think he had a fucking band with him. Everyone in Madison Square Garden's like, what's happening? And then you guys came out, and I didn't go see you. Because, I don't know, it was strange for me when Bill left. Was it strange for you?
Absolutely. I was furious. I sent out the hitman. Except I love him so much. Yeah. I can't go that far.
Yeah.
I'll just break your legs.
Yeah, right.
No, but yeah, no, it was a hard call, man.
Yeah. He'd tire out?
Yeah. And it also developed this fear of flying.
Oh, really?
So he was like driving to every gig, which is like, sometimes they were so far, but
Right.
And eventually he decided, it was his decision.
Yeah, yeah.
To call it the day. And I said, are you kidding me, man?
What are you going to do, right?
You were in the RAF in 1956.
Right.
Schlepping around in Germany.
Yeah.
No, he was adamant, and he made his decision, and maybe it was right for him.
Right.
And all I can say is that, ooh, I get Darryl Jones.
Yeah, yeah. He was great. It was great. It was the first time I'd seen you guys in a long time. And like I said, I was nervous because I hadn't seen you in 35 years. And man, what a fucking, you sounded great. And I mean, there was moments there where,
we've improved over time.
Yeah, you've gotten good. I think you're really tight right now. You're good right now.
I'm going to take it up.
Yeah. But the experience of it was, there was moments where Mick was running, running back and forth. Do you ever, like at the point where you guys are at now, we're mature gentlemen. You're a little more mature than me. Do you have moments where you're like, I hope he doesn't fall the fuck down?
Oh, no, I never worry about... No, Mick is so nimble, man. And
it's crazy.
I mean, Charlie and I always watch Mick in case... when you get out
there in
the audience that you're not hearing the beat.
Right, right.
The same as it actually is. But we're actually experts. Like, he's crossed the beat. Okay. And
Mick?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, we're like a safety net under Mick. He doesn't realize it, probably. But, Charlie and I always say, okay.
We got him.
We can actually do that,
That's hilarious.
Yeah. Well, that's where the job of a band is, to, support the front man.
Yeah, yeah. And now, when you got, when we talked before, you talk a lot about the band and your band and the band. But I have to assume that when you guys started out, at the beginning, you were just a bunch of buddies, right?
Yeah.
It just evolved into this
brought
thing.
Brought together by the music.
Right. Who was the guy that you guys used to play with or play at his club when you started? Was it Alex Corner? Is that who it
was? Yeah, Alexis Corner.
Alexis Corner.
Yeah, yeah. The Ealing Club, yeah.
And he was like a blues impresario?
Yeah, he at the time probably had... the blues nailed down in London.
Right,
if you wanted to hear blues, you had to see Alexis. He's the only guy playing it, basically.
Right, right.
And also he had Cyril Davis, who was a great harp player with him. And they were good. Alexis wasn't particularly, that good. I remember Alexis one night invited us, Mick and me, up to do a number.
Yeah.
And Mick and I said, we're going to do Roll Over Beethoven.
Yeah.
Alexis, he used to use a thumb pick.
Yeah.
He cut his strings and, I'll leave it to you.
And you just took it?
He didn't want to play that rock and roll.
Oh, really? But, he's a real purist?
Well, kind of.
Yeah.
But also, he appreciated rock and roll and everything, but, he knew that he couldn't... He wouldn't be an addition.
Right. I'm going to bow out on this one. Well, on the new record, You know, I listened to it like a couple of times. Yeah. Cross-Eyed Hearts, the name of the record, right?
Yeah. Man.
So the first song, like I noticed, like you're going way back for that. I mean, that's pre-Jimmy Reed, that's pre-Muddy Waters, Robert Johnson.
That's Robert Johnson.
Because I noticed, like,
it's the tip of the hat to Robert Johnson.
It's like Hellhounds on My Trail, almost, man. It's like it's just a piece.
Yeah.
Like you can hear you breathing. You can hear, you know, every squeak of your fingers and every pick. You know, it's very, it's all very raw and organic, and then you're just sort of like, that's all I got. that's the riff. And no, it's not even, it's like a, it's almost like a blues meditation.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
I thought, you know, that would be, you know when we got all the tracks together, if we're going to put that blues in, it might as well be the starter.
And then,
you know, it's like, you know, when people walk into movies and they say, you know, to them, the overture.
Yeah. It's sort of a subtle overture. And then you bookended it with Goodnight Irene, another blues, different style, more of a folk blues, but on both sides, you got Leadbelly. Yeah, you got Leadbelly and Robert just holding it all in.
Yeah, I wanted to do, a couple of classic American folk songs.
Right.
You know? And the weird thing that happened is that Tom Waits had sent me big book on Leadbelly, and it had just arrived, and I just put it on the table.
Yeah.
And at the same time, a few hours later, in walks my guitar man, Pierre de Beauport.
How long you been with that guy? A million years, right?
Pierre, yeah. No, since early 90s,
yeah.
91.
Yeah.
Brilliant guitar. I mean, I'm lost without him. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, he decides which guitar I'm going to play on songs. That's how much I trust him. And he walked in with this 12 string. So I'm looking at this book of Leadbelly.
Yeah.
That Tom Waits has just sent me, and I'm looking at this 12 string, and I'm saying, I have no choice. I've been ordered to do Goodnight Irene.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's pretty haunting music. Some of his stuff, huh?
Oh, yeah, Leadbelly was deep. And I found the original lyrics, you know, which are much...
I know, I didn't know them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're much raunchier than...
Right.
Because then it became, you know, you'd get the black and white minstrels singing it. I mean...
Right.
And it became like an American folk song.
Right,
people would waltz to it and stuff.
Nah, but it was kind of a dirty song.
The real show.
Yeah. So what, like, you got a guitar guy, this guy Pierre, but like you're pretty committed to like a handful of guitars. Like there's four or five that you play pretty much all the time.
Yeah, pretty much. When it comes down to work, yeah.
And I was watching, I was trying to figure it out on stage because I bought a Tele because of you way back when. But not a good one, but I had it.
Yeah.
I think you were on the cover of Guitar Player, but yeah, I think you had one that was altered. I don't remember. It had the rhythm pickup was regular, and then there was a humbucker, on the lead pickup.
We do screw around with them. we do rewire them.
Yeah.
And we do play around with the pickups on them. Yeah.
And you play that 54 all the time. That cream one, right?
Yeah.
For years.
Yes, yeah, boom, and bashing the hell out of it still, you know.
What do you go into, though? You're like, you're not a pedal guy now, are you? No pedals?
No.
Just straight in.
Hey, man, I mean, it's enough to stand up straight. Let alone poking around on buttons, you know.
So you just change the volume when you need to.
Yeah, and also I mean, any of those effects that I need actually can be done from behind. Pierre's if we need a little tremolo. We'd do it from, because I need to know where to put my feet.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, tripping over those boxes.
Yeah.
That just ties you down.
Yeah. Now, what made you decide, because when I talked to you before, you guys were maybe going to do Sticky Fingers. You're going to run all three. But that died in one night. And the recording of it sounded great. So what made you the next night decide, like, no, we're not going to do it?
Well, I don't know, maybe Mick's a better one to ask on that, but you just thought, and I think we all thought that, doing it the whole thing once was enough, and we were, that actually was sweating our balls getting through it, you know.
Really?
But the whole album, you know.
I mean, sure.
The hardest one to play and one of the most beautiful ones is I Got the Blues,
right,
which is so slow.
Yeah.
And it's very, the hardest thing for a band is to keep a slow tempo down. I mean, everything tends to speed up. So it has to be, you know, that Steve Cropper was great at Otis, you know.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And Al Jackson, the drummer, you know, in Memphis.
But you guys didn't want to drop into that. I also noticed, I think that there's to be the greatest rock and roll band and the biggest rock and roll show, you know, you got to be big. You know what I mean? You did Moonlight Mile, which was beautiful. He hit those fucking notes. That was crazy.
I started to like playing that on the stage. At first, I thought, going out on a limb here, Mick. You know, it's a little sparse. But as we got into it, it was beautiful to play and great fun, and they were loving it out there.
Yeah. Speaking of Otis, I was thinking about, like, because you know he could lay back on that groove, but it's, I was thinking about, what did you, after you know Satisfaction was a hit and then he decided to cover it, that must have been a big fucking day.
Yeah, put another crown on, baby. You know?
Yeah, right.
I mean, for one of our songs to be covered by one of the greatest R&B singers of all time, it was, let's die and go to heaven, you know, I mean, or wherever. I know, because that was basically the cream on the, on the whole thing. And then Aretha did it, and, and then we were like in double heaven.
Yeah.
But, no, it was great to get that respect and that respond and reciprocation back from, hey, after all, he played black music.
Right. You know,
and we're white as white can be.
and he found that groove, though. Like, you know, to make that a soul song was something, huh?
Yeah.
Right. It was amazing.
And it was just amazing that these people that respected and admired so much would do one of our songs.
And then you played with, on this record, on the new record, you use Spooner Oldham, right?
Spooner's there,
and he played with Aretha on some of the big hits, right?
Yeah.
Down in Muscle Shoals. So that must have been amazing to work with that guy. You'd worked with him before?
No, first time I've ever met Spooner, although I've known him, I feel like I've known him for years because he's been on so many records. I was actually Graham Parsons that first pointed out Spooner Oldham to me.
Really?
And that was in like 71 or 70.
He knew it. He felt it.
Graham knew country music, and Spooner was basically a country music player at that time. I didn't even know that he was still around. And a couple of phone calls, Steve Jordan, bless his heart, the man I work with, and, who co-wrote these songs with me and produced it, you know.
Great drummer.
Fantastic drummer.
Been playing with him a long time on your solo stuff.
Yeah, I was turning him. Charlie Watts said to me in about 85, 86, we knew the Stones were going to take a hiatus or a hibernation or whatever you want to call it. And Charlie Watts said, if you're going to work with anybody else, Steve Jordan's your man.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And I took him at his word. I listened to Charlie assiduously. And Steve and I started to work together. And not only we just sort of worked together, we fell into each other's arms, and he was a great friend of mine.
That's great. It's beautiful, man. Yeah, I mean, it's nice to walk into a studio with a bunch of dudes you know and trust, and we're going to make something.
And so, you know, the Winos came together, you know, Ivan Neville, man. You know, Waddy Wachtel, who I can never
forever
praise.
You play with that guy.
I love that guy.
Long time, right? Great player.
Great.
Yeah.
It's simpatico.
Yeah. And this was the last record that Bobby Keys played on?
Unfortunately, yeah.
I'm sorry you lost your friend, man.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah. Hey, Bobby's probably laughing his head off. We had no idea that was going to be his last recorded stuff when we did it. But, Bobby... Hey, that's Mr. Rock and Roll, man. As large as Texas, if not larger.
Between the two of you, it's like you're both Mr. Rock and Roll. He certainly lived the life.
He certainly did.
Now, when you lose somebody that you've been with around with that long, but you know, I guess at some point you realize that you know we're all living on borrowed time, and he certainly didn't waste any, right?
Right. No. He said, "I ain't got no time to lose, baby."
Is that what he said? No. Before you met Graham, though, you were into country music, but do you think Parsons really kind of blew your mind on it, or what?
It's just that I met Graham in London. He was actually with the Byrds at the time. They'd done Sweetheart of the Rodeo.
Yeah.
And they'd stopped in London and did a couple of gigs. And then they were destined to go play South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to bump into Graham that night. I went to see the show, and we got to talking after. And he said, I'm getting this sort of feeling, you know, about South Africa, and I don't know, you know, I don't understand it, I don't know. So I explained to him, he said, it's like going to the South, honey, but even worse.
Yeah.
You know, this is like, you know, this isn't segregation, this is apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
And once he'd done this, he said, well, and he left the Byrds that day and stayed with me in London.
Oh, really? He just let them go on their own?
Yeah.
On principle?
Yeah.
Nah. Yeah. That's fucking beautiful.
Yeah. And they became very, very close friends. Had a few cold turkeys together.
Sweat it out?
Yeah.
That's sad, too. Yeah, that guy died so young.
Yeah, man. That's another one, you know.
But you still do. Like, it's interesting. Like, this record, you know, it's got all the stuff that you love on it. You know, you've got your soul ballad. You know, you got your country music,
a couple of reggae country songs.
The reggae, the reggae was really good, man. I was like, he's like doing reggae again, but you love it.
I've always loved it. I've lived in Jamaica for many years.
Yeah, you don't got that place anymore.
Oh yeah,
you still have it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah,
but at the time you got it though, didn't you have to get it? Like you couldn't come home, right?
I burnt the passport actually.
Yeah. Because someone sent me that box set that you did with those guys in the cave or something. What was that?
The Wingless Angels.
Yes.
Yeah, man. The Rastafarian.
Those recordings are crazy, man.
Yeah.
It's just like hours of like, you know, I'm like, oh, there's Keith. I can hear a little Keith there, you know?
I was just backing up.
Right, you know? Yeah.
I was letting the guys have their
thing. Wild, man.
And, yeah, luckily, because nearly all of them have passed away since.
Oh, yeah. It's a nice box, that box.
Yeah, it was a great experience, and it was sort of, just to capture some of the last moments of this particular part of Jamaican culture.
Yeah.
And I managed to do it.
Yeah.
And they loved it. We had great fun. I mean, you couldn't have funnier sessions in your life.
Yeah.
With that lot.
A lot of weed.
What do you want? A rum and milk.
Yeah. So in terms of, you know, being at the age you're at now and in sort of the type of songwriting you're doing, because there's a couple of songs on here, like on the new record, like Amnesia and Nothing on Me, like where I felt were sort of like, you know, celebrations of being still alive in a way. You know what I mean?
In a way, I guess. Everything is. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Nothing on Me is basically about being busted.
Right, right. I mean, yeah.
And it wasn't until after listening to the whole record that I realized that the cops crop up a lot in this record, you know, on Rob Bland.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Oh, that's right. Yeah. Well, you made it. You're not wanted anymore. You're good,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And there's no warrants out for that. No.
You're set. You're solid. Yeah, well, let's talk about guitar players for a minute. Like, because, all right, so you lost Brian. And then you bring Mick in, then you toured with Mick a bit, Mick Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess my question, if I'm really going to focus it, just out of my own curiosity, because there was some shift where you guys sort of invented modern rock and roll. There was some shift, you know, probably right in the middle or right after Satanic Majesties, where the entire sound and the groove became what the modern Stones are. What do you think? What happened to sort of make that happen? Was it? Was there a moment where you're like, "This is where it's at"? I mean, the difference between how you cover, like, you know, "Love in Vain" or what you did with the blues and country music on "Let It Bleed" and "Beggars" in "Exile," like it just that became the template for rock and roll from that point forward.
You know, in a way, I can put this in two words: Jimmy Miller,
producer.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did he affect that? How did he influence it? What did he say?
Well, after Satanic Majesties, we were, you know, Mick and I were like, we have to refocus, man. And that, I mean, that was a mad year. I mean, you know, there was Sergeant Pepper and Satanic Majesties. But, you know, well, I guess they're all on acid, right? You know, I mean, which is true enough.
So you did a little acid. Yeah, you did the thing.
Oh, they've gone to India.
So you had to keep up with the Beatles.
I mean, no, we had to refocus. Like, and at that
time, that's interesting. So that was the end of you keeping up with the Beatles. You're like, we got to do our shit.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't go anywhere near there, and I realized that they, the Beatles, the boys themselves, are sort of outpaced themselves in a way. You know, and they were, you know.
Well, they lasted, that was it. They did the
What are you going to do? Numero uno, numero uno, numero. And so they started to, like, you know, like anybody else, to play around. And But that was 67, like 66, 67.
Right.
Those years were, I mean, it was crazy. I mean, there was LSD all over the place.
Right.
And so if you made...
Did you like that shit?
I had a couple of good trips and a couple of bad ones, you know, just like anything else, you know.
Right.
but no, it was not something that I'd wake up in the morning and sort of say, I must have a tab, you know.
Right. Because then what are you going to do for the next 3 days?
Yeah, no, it's crazy.
Yeah.
It was interesting.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't say I don't regret any of it, but it was an experiment.
Right.
But how I think, in a way, it kind of shook Mick and I up because we said, boom, now we really got to tighten up. You know, this is why we got Beggar's Banquet. And I got to say that Jimmy Miller was the key in tightening the band up and refocusing, so to speak.
Well, it seems like you guys, like you said about, you know, doing, you know, yeah, you want me to do it. About smoking that first cigarette in 10 years with Keith Richards. I don't know why I wouldn't do that. Thanks, man.
I'm a bad influence, man.
Not you, Keith. That sounds so... Not you. You're not a bad influence. So, but in terms of... Because when you talk about it, you know, I got the blues... You know, and that laid back thing. I mean, somebody, you know, relaxed the band. And if it was Jimmy Miller, how did he do that necessarily? You know what I mean? Get you into that groove. Because the sound is pretty different from Aftermath to fucking Beggars.
Yeah. It was, I think, after the Satanic Majesties, I think we'd actually reached the end of our tether. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd been working 350 days a year, man, for like 4 years.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, there was, you know, where did you go on your vacation? Vacation? Yeah, forget about it.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
If we weren't in, on the road, we were in the studio. And I think, yeah, basically, even at that age, you know, we'd pretty much worn ourselves out. The year between that and bringing and getting Beggar's Banquet together was basically re-energizing, getting some rest, re-energizing and refocusing. And as I say, to me, it was Jimmy Miller that put the lens in the focus, you know. And so he was a drummer.
He was
great sense of
sound,
and he loved the band, you know? I mean, and he brought out the best in us.
And did Brian die in the middle of that?
Somewhere around there, yeah. Brian, I mean, he's the kind of guy you love to hate.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, he was
brilliant but annoying. Is that what you're saying?
Brilliant, yes. Beyond annoying. No, that motherfucker.
Yeah.
He would, you know, we'd be in Chicago and play a gig, and he'd get asthma. And he's got, I got to play 3 weeks in the Midwest without another guitar player.
I mean, so he's
fragile. Thank God the girls were screaming loud enough. But, I mean, I'm trying to cover all bases.
Yeah.
And then I find out that he was out of the hospital the next day and like hanging around screwing groupies and... excuse me, man, we need a little more dedication, you know?
You need a guitar, you got a job.
Yeah.
You have a job, yeah. You're in a band.
So it went kind of from there, yeah, you know. I mean, that he was, you know, he became a drag.
Yeah, yeah. And then when Mick Taylor comes in, that was a whole different kind of guitar player, right? I mean, it's really interesting, the difference between, you know, like Taylor and Wood. But like Mick Taylor was like, he was a big part of the sound for a couple albums, huh?
He certainly was. I mean, a brilliant guitar player.
Yeah. How's he doing?
This for the last I saw him, I mean, he's doing all right. He's a bit chubby. Oh, yeah. But that's his privilege, right?
Yeah.
But he plays great. And we worked together for a couple of years. But, you know, Taylor, you know, I mean, to me, I'm a guitar player. But, you know... On my own,
I really,
it doesn't interest me. My interest is in playing off of the other guy and
what you can put
together, because two guitars can sound like an orchestra if you do it right.
Right, play off each other.
And that's really what
as
Ronnie and Ice, call it, the ancient form of weaving.
Right.
It's like where you don't know who's playing lead, who's playing rhythm.
That's what you did.
That it all switches through, you know.
And Mick Taylor was kind of his own dude, right?
Yeah. So I had to readjust for that. And at that same time, I just gotten into the five-string thing, so I was rearranging my sound.
Where'd you learn that?
I tell you what, Rykuda was the first cat that I learned it from. I saw playing it.
Yeah.
I didn't learn it because he wouldn't teach you anything. Ry keeps his secrets and bless his heart.
Yeah.
But I'm still finding out, man. I mean, it's what you can do with it, because it's a whole different... But to me, it sort of reinterested me in playing guitar, because I was pretty much at the end of my possibilities on just straight tuning. I'm not going to be Charlie Christian.
You accepted
and
that.
And I don't want to be. When I got to the open G thing, I started to really research it. How to play a minor chord with open G, and you get all of these resonating notes and drone notes and stuff. That fascinate and still do, you know. So.
Well, that's what makes, that's the genius of Keith right there. It's funny. You're talking about the Beatles. I can't believe I'm smoking my first cigarette in 10 years with Keith Richards in an NPR studio. Huh?
How about that?
Fuck everything. We're smoking in NPR. Yeah. You know what album I love? That what song I love is when you play with George Jones.
Oh, on the Bradley Barn thing.
I fucking listen to that all the time, man.
That was a real honor for me.
Was it?
I mean, yeah, to work with George Jones. I mean, first off, Graham Parsons and I, you know, say Graham Parsons with George Jones is like the. And he's the singer.
The greatest singer.
Amazing. He's there with, Aaron Neville is another cat that can use the voice as if it's, you know, effortless and do anything with it. Frank Sinatra once said that he thought George Jones was the second best singer. I would take exception with that.
amazing voice
and a great guy, crazy as nuts in there. But
were you guys playing off each other in the studio at the same time?
Like that.
You feel it too, man. It's a beautiful song.
Darling, there's talk around town.
It's fucking great. And you played with you did a record with Jerry Lee.
Yeah, and Jerry Lee is another great friend of mine.
Yeah, still?
Yeah.
He's still hanging in, huh?
Man, he's amazing, man.
I guess you old devils got to stick together a little bit.
I guess. We've had our tiffs and we've had our... You know, but no, Jerry and I, you know, it's sort of a recognition of similar souls.
Right, And you were able to play with Muddy, and you played when Buddy's still around, so you play with him sometimes?
Yeah. Buddy was on the show with us in Minneapolis. Or Milwaukee.
Did you play with Wolf?
Howlin' Wolf, yeah, once on that... Shindig TV
show.
Oh, I think we didn't actually play with him. No, I was there.
And you watched?
Yeah. I once woke up in his house.
How'd that happen?
Well, I don't know. I fell asleep at Muddy's. I woke up in Howlin' Wolf.
In Chicago?
Yeah. It was some party or something, you know. They must have carried me from one on. What are we going to do with this white kid? I don't know. We're just taking with us.
What the fuck? There must have been a lot of lost weeks, Keith.
There must have been a few here and there. Here and there. Yeah.
How do you level up? How do you manage? I mean, we don't need to get too far into it. You got pretty strung out for a few years.
Oh yeah.
And
deliberately, you know, it's an experiment.
Yeah, is that how you view it? An experiment for a few years.
Yes, I'm the laboratory.
When did you realize that the experiment was over?
It was going on too long.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you've been threatened with, you know, 7 years hard time, you know.
That'll do it?
Yeah. Hey, I love my band more than I love the stuff.
Oh, good. Yeah. So you're able just to taper off and get into a management system?
Boom. I just kicked it.
Yeah. And what a relief, huh?
Yeah. In a way, I mean, I got sick of dealers and junkies, you know. Because that's, you end up in that stuff, you end up, and that's, you realize that the only people you're talking to are like, are they strung out cats?
That's right. Like, you're in a hotel room full of people you don't know who are
waiting for the man and all
right,
that. And,
right.
And so it was, it was time to cut that out. And cut it.
You know what's scary about that is that if you're in a room full of five or six of those dudes or whoever that attracts, if you go down, if you fucking OD, you know what? You're going to be alone in that room.
Oh, yeah.
No one's going to fucking call the cops.
Tell
no
me
one's
about gonna, it.
Right?
Yeah, man.
Oh, shit, he's down. Let's
I've
go.
I've seen the bodies.
Yeah. It's a scary fucking world. Oh, my God. I didn't realize you put out a new book that I downloaded to read on the plane, Gus and Me.
Oh, and yeah.
I read your children's book. I thought it would take a little longer. It took me 8 minutes, but I downloaded it.
It took me 4 minutes to read it.
And to write it.
Yeah.
But it's really a pretty book. I mean, did you ever think in your life that you would be a children's book writer?
No, you think, I mean, when the idea came up, I thought, are you kidding me?
Right. Who came up with that idea?
The publishers of life, of my own book. They'd come up with this idea about, there was a chapter in there about my grandfather.
Uh-huh.
And they said, this could be a really like nice children's story, and I thought, if I'm going to write anything and do anything for kids, I can only talk about something I love, you know, which is my granddad and the guitar.
Yeah,
you know, so it was, in a way, it was like taking my hats off to Gus, who was great to me.
He threw you a line. He was your lifesaver. It's a pretty, it's a cute little book, and your daughter illustrated it.
It was a family affair.
Yeah, it was, but she did a great job. Those are really pretty.
Yeah.
It's a pretty little book. I couldn't believe I'm reading. I'm getting choked up reading a Keith Richards children's book.
I know. I love to sort of throw you the odd.
I'm listening to your record, and then I'm reading your children's book, and I'm like, what the fuck? All I wanted to do was drugs, but
I'm broadening my horizons.
I'll say, man. Well, you've got some grandkids, right?
I've got five.
Five.
Yeah.
Do you love hanging out with them?
Yeah. It's worth hanging around to be a granddad, you know, yeah.
Did you ever think you would? I mean, it's
At certain times, no. You know, but here I am, and there's five grandkids, and they're... And it's another thing, you know, it takes you on another level. It's one thing being a father.
Yeah.
Which is, like, fun enough.
You had a couple shots at that.
Yeah.
Yeah, two sets.
Yeah, two sets of that. And out they come, you know, but they're great little kids.
Yeah.
And,
What, do they have name for you? Just grandpa or granddad or what do they call you?
Grandpa.
Yeah.
Him.
And you get along with all your kids?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, it's a very close family in that respect.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's like a tribe.
How were you with your dad growing up, you know, in general? I mean, because I know you loved Gus, but your father, did you guys fight it out for a few years? Or?
I don't know. I grew up with just my mom and my dad.
Yeah.
You know, so I grew up in a very adult area, you mm-hmm. know. So, I mean, sometimes, you know, I was sort of, wished I had a brother or a sister so I didn't have to listen to about the arguments about the rent and and the insurance right. and whatever,
right.
you know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But there's no way out of that. So you sort of grow up in an adult household, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
And they treat you like a kid, and at the same time, you know they have problems. And but not between themselves, but just like day-to-day living, you know. Yeah. I mean, my dad worked his life for General Electric, making tubes.
Right.
So
Of all things,
yeah. And this right. I'll get around to in a minute. But so I leave home, 17, like the bird leaves the nest. And within a year, my mum and my dad had split up. I think I was the only reason to stay around. But suddenly I'm making some bread. I take care of mum.
Yeah.
Yeah. My dad, whatever, for 20 years, no contact whatsoever.
Really?
Yeah. And in 82, I think 81, 82, I just sent a note and said, see if you can get this through to my dad. You know, Why haven't we seen each other for so long? So my dad comes down to my house, you know, I send him, and I'd taken Ronnie Wood with me because I wanted protection. So I meet my dad after 20 years, I was scared shitless.
Really?
So, yeah, in a way, you know, yeah. I mean, I needed some
kind of support.
Shield, yeah. And out comes me dad, you know, 20 years older, a little old bloke, gray, and we snapped to straight away, you know. I mean, we just like got on, and I had more fun with him for the next 20 years. I showed him the world, you know. I said, get on this plane, come on. And he's got Brooke Shields sitting on his lap.
Yeah.
And I gave him the whole world he hadn't seen. And for the last 20 years of his life, we were like, we play dominoes endlessly, you know, with a load of other guys, you know, and he was he liked his rum.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there you go.
But he could drink us all under the table.
Oh, yeah?
It was amazing, you know.
That's beautiful, man. And your mom?
Bless her heart, yes, always saw her. And the funny thing about my mom is that she knows she's going, you know. I went to the hospital, you know, to the clinic.
When whatever. Was this?
It's 2002, uh-huh. I think.
Uh-huh.
And so I brought a guitar with me, and I was sitting on the end of the bed, and she said, Keith, this morphine's not bad, is it? You're 93 at last.
Now you get it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fucking beautiful. So the new record's great, man. And
cool, man.
Love everything you do. And to finish up, like when you look back, not so much about regrets, but is there anything you're still pissed off about? Is anything stuck in your craw about the way things went down?
I could have lived without being busted, and without being like, you know, cops putting things in my pocket, stuff.
Oh, that happened, yeah.
Oh yeah,
got set up.
It was terrible in London.
Oh, the first big bust.
Yeah, no, it was the second one. What have we got here?
Oh, really?
But I did have the pleasure of that gentleman. His name was, at the time, was Constable.
Uh-huh.
And it was Constable Constable.
Constable Constable.
Yeah, he got to be a sergeant or something. before he was finally checked. Nothing to do with me by then, but I just read in a paper that he was sentenced to 5 years.
Oh, really? Yeah, you don't even know why. Fuck him.
Yeah, well, probably for the same thing.
Send people up.
Just corruption or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a bent station and, it's one of those things, cops ain't perfect and nor am I.
So Ronnie's good.
Ronnie's good.
Charlie's good. You and Mick are good.
Yeah.
Everything's all right.
Yeah. And looking forward to doing some more. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for talking to me. It was a real honor. Really fucking amazing.
A pleasure, man. A lot of laugh.
Yeah.
And you smoked your first cigarette in 10
years. Yeah, with Keith Richards. Come on. Thanks, man.
Pleasure, man.
Okay, that was it. That was me and Keith. That was crazy. I got choked up. Oh, my God. Whoo! All right. I'm a fun one. Remember, he said that. I'm a fun one. All right. So I hope that wasn't too embarrassing for me. Fucking me and Keith Richards, man. Come on. I got to play a Telecaster now. You can go to WTFpod.com. For all your WTF pod needs, get a little justcoffee.coop. I get a little back on the back end there on the WTF blend. They've been with us since the beginning. What else? Yeah, get on the mailing list. Check the schedule. I'll be in Australia in October. Man, you guys. You heard it. I talked to Keith Richards. I can't fucking believe it. Now what do I do? That's it. People ask me, what are you going to do after Obama? What am I going to do after Keith Richards? Boomer lives!